Access number 28650, Mr. Gordon Mellor, Reel 7. Now, we're talking about your time with 31 Air Navigation School at Port Albert, Ontario, which is near Goderich, from April 41 onwards, really. Were there any new techniques of navigation being introduced, or was it just this triangulation, this...
It was all, quite honestly, it was all basic navigation.
And what about how much study? I mean, there's a bit. It's a burning the midnight oil before exams is a photograph and the other thing. Did you have to work hard to keep up? I mean, and were the exams stringent? You know.
Well, they were there to find out how much you knew. The questions were always relevant. I don't think any of them were there to catch you out. Some of them, of course, were. You were given a. A log, and you had to plot the log out and come up with certain results, which they would then compare with the standard, with the exercise standard, and you would be marked on your accuracy and whether you got it all done in the time. Others were written exercises like any ordinary exam and any ordinary question which can crop up. We had to hand in our logs and charts at the end of each flight. So I always assumed that they were examined, and I rather fancy that the second in command did most of the appraisal of our exercises in the air. And we then got the papers back. The charts, obviously, to reuse where possible, and the I can't remember what happened to the logs. They probably went for salvage, I expect, in the end.
What were living conditions like? I mean, you were in a hut, I presume.
Basic hut, yes, basic wooden prefabricated hut. On this particular camp, they were in the form of a letter H. We had one. Wing on one side of the H. There would be another course on the other side of the H, and in the middle there were toilets, washing facilities, and the usual facilities, showers. You get used to living in an open space with 25 other people. So that you haven't got any real privacy. You can sort of close you off from somebody else if you wanted to, which happened when people wanted to write letters, and if they wanted to do it there, or they could go down to the one of the recreation huts.
Was there much ball in how clean you were meant to keep them? I noticed there's preparations for the air officer commanding to visit, and that's different in a way because that's a special event.
Well, yes.
Was there much ball?
You had to keep the place clean, yes. I mean, there was a great big expanse of brown linoleum from wall to wall, end to end. And you had to broom out your own sort of dust and fluff from underneath your bunks. The bunks, in actual fact, were in twos, one above the other. As far as I can recall, I had the bottom one, and Johnny King had the top one. But it rather sort of made the place look untidy, I suppose, but then however untidy a frame, metal frame, and they looks, it was all repeated, so found that you did live in fairly close quarters. You weren't spaced a great distance from anybody else. There was a locker there for you to put your spare gear in, and room to store your kit bags as well.
What about the food? Was that just normal RAF food, or was it?
Oh no, that was Canadian messing.
How did that differ? Just out of interest.
Yeah, the basic ingredients didn't differ a great deal. The presentation was a bit different. They used to serve up pancakes and honey or. Some form of sweetener with it, and you'd eat that with eggs and bacon, flapjacks or whatever they called them. There was more watery fruit, melon sort of material, but it was fairly well same as REF food over in this country, except there was more of it, and it seemed to be a little lighter in overall content. Indeed, there was more fruit available.
So probably a better diet.
By modern thinking.
Probably it was.
Yes, I couldn't disagree with that. It was very acceptable.
I like my food. What would a typical day be like? You know, what was your day? I don't mean in great, because we've done some of this before.
Yeah.
What would a sort of typical day's training be like at?
The usual sort of get up. I think we were due in the education block, ready to go at 9 o'clock in the morning. It may have been slightly earlier. I don't think we ever had a great rush. There was no sort of parade sort of business. They expected you to walk or march over to the camp reasonably smartly, and we'd have a morning which would be split up into probably 3/4 hour lectures, and they were mixed up, so you weren't sitting down all that long. In fact, you'd spend a second period exercising, or maybe you'd go over to do some radio work.
Doing wireless work.
To a certain extent, yes, merely trying to get speed up. I mean, it was nowhere near as concentrated as the radio operators did.
It was a second string in your bow, not the first string.
No, well, we were observers, you see, which was everything else but the pilot, so to speak. When there were aircraft like the Fairey Battle, then there may be two or three in the crew there. You had far more range of duties than the later aircraft like Lancasters and Halifaxes, where everybody had a specialised job.
These lectures, in different sessions then?
Split up to keep our interest going. And in some cases it was you were doing exercises, in others you were listening to somebody talking or demonstrating, and you'd take your own notes. We would then have break, lunchtime, and the afternoon, very often you had the whole afternoon flying. Some afternoons, we had exercise, football matches or something of that style. And the following day, then it could be turned round, and you might have had a lecture the previous day, and you find you're doing the exercise the next morning in the air. So that they tried to split it up so that you held your interest during the daytime hours.
Now, so what about recreation? So what would you do for that in the evening?
There was a camp cinema. There was an occasional entertainment. There was the odd dance, if you were interested. There were recreation rooms. You could play table tennis, snooker. I think there was a squash court there, but I think that was reserved largely for permanent staff. We didn't sort of get onto it. Oh, there was badminton. Yes, we had a chance to play badminton. That wasn't compulsory. It was available, and you had to book up for a period of an hour or something like that if you could get a game together.
Now, how did you get on with the locals? You mentioned the sort of cafe girl, the cafe opposite. You also mentioned at some point about their brother.
Yes, well, it so happened that the aerodrome was built on farmland, and more than one farm was involved, but there was a young lad there that we've since been in contact, and his two sisters actually ran the this cafe opposite, or pull up for Carmen or whatever it was. And other than that, we didn't have any contact with them. But I think it was about the second or third weekend after we arrived that we had an invitation to go to the town of Stratford, or Stratford-on-Avon, as they like to call it. And we all piled into a coach on the Saturday lunchtime or thereabouts and went a fair distance to Stratford. And when we got out in the centre of the town there, we were taken into a hall. And local residents had set this up. They were there, and they were taking people off in pairs to entertain them for the weekend. So that young lady approached us, and she said, "Hello, I'm so-and-so," whatever it was. And I said, "Well, oh, I'm Gordon Miller. This is Johnny King, my friend here." So she said, "Right, Gordon and John, would you like to come with me?" So we did. And we got into a very nice car, and she drove us off out of the centre of town into a residential area. And there was a each house had a fair sized plot of land, and there the house stood isolated in the centre of each plot. And of course there were no fences. The grass from the house, the whole of the front of the gardens were open, so that if you wanted to speak to your neighbour, then they could just sort of walk across the grass, providing it wasn't wet and muddy. So there was a longish sort of footpath up to the house, and there was a drive which you drove the car in, the garage, and it was a very nice detached house, and we were introduced to the rest of the family, her mother and father, who were principal hosts, and we entertained there with drinks and dinner in the evening, which was very nicely done. They had put on roast beef, especially for the two of us, and we eventually were allocated our rooms each, and we slept there overnight. Woke up, dressed to a very nice breakfast. And Johnny was a Roman Catholic, so he was taken off to church before breakfast, and I had a leisurely breakfast, and then I joined the rest of the family, and went down to their particular church and attended the service. We saw other people there who got some of our course, some of in little groups of two. And then had a lunch which was attended by the family and one or two friends of the family at a restaurant close to, now I don't know what sort of, no, it wasn't, it was an inland lake, small, it wasn't exactly big, but I think there was a river running through it. Because they served up local trout. But we had a great lunch, and of course we had to be ready to come back. I think it was that same day, and yet I have a feeling we slept there twice for two nights. Perhaps we went on the Friday. Perhaps we went on the Friday, and we had the Saturday and Sunday there, and we came back on the Sunday after. Early evening.
But all told, very hospitable.
Indeed, I can't remember their name offhand at the moment, but they were the Canadian people were very hospitable. We saw them again, and on the whole, I would say we were we struck very lucky. We were very lucky in the people that we met.
Now you had some local leave in Toronto as well.
Yes.
It seems to be quite an enjoyable visit, judging by the photographs in your thing.
Oh, yes. That was later on that we had... I got a feeling we had finished the basic navigation course. Or had we? I'm not sure. Anyhow, we did make two more visits. One, we did a weekend on our own. Another chap and I. It wasn't Johnny King. He was occupied that weekend. I seem to remember. And we hitchhiked to Niagara Falls. And we didn't have any particular arrangement. We saw a smallish hotel, which we thought might suit our pocket. And so we went to Niagara and sampled the delights. We stayed in this small hotel, and of course we had to hitchhike back. That gave us a bit of an insight as to what the place was like, and we did eventually have another visit. But the main period that we had was, I think, 7 days leave, or thereabouts. And now that's not entirely true. We did have as we had in with Niagara, we did have a weekend trip, but this was an organised one through the camp, and a coach was provided. And on the Friday afternoon, after lectures, we set off. And Toronto is about 140 miles away. Everything went well until we were on the stretch getting towards Toronto. We'd been through Hamilton, and one of the wheels of the lorry coach came off whilst we were going along at a reasonable lick, so that that corner of the coach sort of dropped down, and we were skidding around on the highway for a distance until we pulled up, and the wheel actually sort of went off over the verge at the side and disappeared across a field, still running. But that rather put the coach out of action. So there was a somewhere round about 45 to 50 of us hanging around on the road while they tried to get some assistance, which was not very quick in coming. So we knew where we were going to stay, and so we started to sort of thumb a ride, and I'm not sure who it was with now. I'm not sure whether John was with us or not. Anyhow, three of us got a lift in a very nice car, and he said, "Where are you heading for?" We said, "Well, wherever you can drop us off so we can get to Toronto." He said, "Oh, that's no problem. I'm going that way. I'll take you there." I said, "Well, you know, it's quite a fair way still." He said, "No, I think nothing of it." And typical Canadian, he took us. And he said, where are you staying?" So we said, "Ford Hotel." He said, "Oh, I know where that is." So he took us right to the door. And it took, and this was in night time then, and we were intensely grateful for him. He said, "That's all right, not to worry, have a good time." So we booked in at the Ford Hotel, and the others came in by similar methods during the night. So we had a visit there. And, now let's see. The time was our own until 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock on the Sunday. Some people had already got relatives who they'd been in contact with, so they were fixed up for accommodation and also for entertainment. But I was with a chap called Selman and another one called Bat. And they're both in my course. And He said, I have connections here. We'll see what can event. So we did get entertainment organised for us, and we had a thoroughly good time. And we were turned back to the Sunday afternoon, and the coach arrived and been repaired, and we were. Went back to Port Albert that weekend and started work again. That was an intermediate one. We did make another trip to Port Albert, which was at the end of the course, in which I got to know some people through our first visit. by the name of Selby. And the three of us again made contact with them. He was an executive of the Ontario Motor League, which I think was an organisation similar to the AA or the RAC. I think in this case they were affiliated to the RAC. And they entertained us for the 7 days. On the last day, I think they were scheduled to go to up onto the Muskoka Lakes or something like that. So they left us in the house in the morning, and they said, well, you know, just shut up, you know, lock up when you leave, and everything would be all right. So they'd been most entertaining. We met a number of quite important people, and there was a band leader that we met. He played at the Royal York Hotel regularly, so we had dinner there one evening and listened to him, and we also were entertained by him one afternoon and evening. So that filled in our 7 days very nicely. And on top of that, they also organised a trip to Niagara for us, so we went back, but this time we stayed at the General Brock Hotel, which was probably 5-star or something like that, as opposed to the small family hotel where we'd stayed at on the first occasion. And we had a thoroughly nice trip to Niagara, going over on the ferry, and we came back to Toronto on the ferry again. So that was middle part of that week's stay. And this was paid for by the organisation that Mr.
Selby.
Mr. Selby. For the people who he worked for.
Now, round about that time, July, you were assessed as having passed your Air Observer's navigation course, which
yes.
you were doing.
Yes.
You seem to have passed with 79.5, seems to be a good mark. It just says passed. Anything else about your time there?
Well, yes, we then had another 4 weeks there. We did a course based on astro navigation. We hadn't done anything in the way of sights and what have you on our basic work. But this 4 weeks was related entirely to navigation by sun and the stars.
So what did that entail? What new equipment were you being
introduced? Oh, well, we had a sextant. The measuring devices were shown to us and explained from the type of sextants used in the Navy, where you use the sea horizon as your baseline operate from. And of course, on a ship, then you're up on the bridge, so you have to make an allowance for your height above water as well. Now, for the air navigation, then that'd be no good, because your height to the horizon varies an enormous amount. And so you have, instead of have a natural horizon, you have a bubble in it, the sextant, and you use that bubble as your baseline to work from for taking sights. There was two sorts of sights, one of them which you had to work manually, and you click every time you took a sight, and it averaged out your 6 sights on the one heavenly body. And another one had clockwork attached to it, and that ran for 2 minutes, was it? 2 minutes, I think, and took a far greater number of sights, but it still gave you an average reading, because the bubble jumped about with the vibration in the plane, and if it was bumpy weather, then of course that also affected the measurements you were taking on the stars. But we learned quite a bit about the passage of the planets and being different from the stars and what have you. And we also learned how to use the official books of tables for the time and date of the year.
Now, another thing we've not mentioned yet was photographic reconnaissance. There's a very interesting section here where you've got three photographs, and you know, it's a reconnaissance you made over Midland at Ontario, and
that's
you
right.
had to take pictures of various things.
Yes,
you've done so, and you've got A's for everything. Now, what was the method involved with photographic reconnaissance? What cameras does it involve? Would you know about the cameras, or was it just a button you pressed to you?
Oh yes, I've been interested in photography for since about the age of 10, I think. I've still got my first negative and a print from it. These were bigger cameras altogether. There were two sorts which were available to us. There was those which were mounted on the aircraft frame, and there was an opening in the nose where you could take your photographs through, and you took them vertical, and you got line overlaps, and there was a number of calculations you had to make, because if the plane was drifting, then you would get a zigzag sort of effect, and the main idea, of course, was to try and get a straight line through. Anyhow, that we worked on those, and we also did, to start with, by taking handheld pictures through an open window in the aircraft.
So they'd be oblique photographs.
Oh, they'd be oblique.
Rather than
oh, yeah.
Straight down.
That's right. That's exactly the right term. And these were all fairly big cameras. I think in every case they were 5-inch by 5-inch size negatives. So that they were capable of producing very great detail. And sometimes we took one or two pictures from high up, 10,000 feet or so, and others, then we tried to get the maximum amount of detail on a particular target, so to speak. So we were given targets to go to, places to go to, navigate to it, and direct the pilots to how you wanted to take the picture,
so
and he would circle round for you.
So in this case, it's a ship loading coal or lakeside ship.
Yes,
loading.
Yes.
I mean, the backs, they're very clear, and the pictures are very clear indeed.
Yes,
and
yes.
The examples you've got stuck in your album.
I was quite proud of them.
Well, I mean, you can see exactly what they are, what they say they are. You know. Did it go any further than that? Was there any development of photography, or was it just another string to your bow?
Oh, it was another string. It was all part of the work that you could be put on when we got back to this country. Being an observer, then you were expected to be able to take photographs if necessary. Developments, of course, were very fast in that field during the wartime period, and I don't think I had the opportunity of doing any handheld obliques ever again. Not there. So it was. We did do photography from the from in Bomber Command, but in that particular case, then that was with other objects in mind.